So this is the second part, taking a look at the really, really fascinating work by Rav Soloveitchik, The Emergence of Ethical Man, a book that wasn't actually published until 2005, way after Rav Soloveitchik's passing, but it was found in his office kind of as a collection of notebooks that he had written. He'd never really finished this book, and he never necessarily intended to publish it, but nonetheless, he wrote this entire really, really fascinating work. And I'll recap in a few moments what we talked about last week, while we hand out the source sheets, which is usually a good thing to do. But if the watchword for last week was that what we were reading was absolutely bonkers, then really the watchword for today is genius. I hope I can do justice to Rav Soloveitchik's argument, but what he does in this kind of stage of the work is just brilliant. It's a masterclass in how to creatively read a biblical text and how to weave really, really complex themes both into and also derive from the text itself. So as we talked about last week, Rav Soloveitchik really begins the work with a desire to challenge what he thinks is the popular view of Judaism disagrees with science. From his perspective, I was distracted by the doorbell, completely lost my train of thought. From his perspective, the way we typically think of things is that Judaism believes man, humanity is unique, is special, and science believes humans are merely upgraded animals. And Rav Soloveitchik basically sets out to say, no, Judaism agrees with the science. We are partly upgraded animals. What Rav Soloveitchik uses here is what are really Kantian philosophical terms, distinguishing between the ontic and the ethical. So ontically speaking, ontically just means what we are, descriptively, practically speaking, we are no different than the animals. What really separates us is, well, The Emergence of Ethical Man, which is the title of the book, and what we're going to take a look at today to try and understand what exactly is ethical man, and as we're going to see today, what ultimately leads to the downfall of ethical man. But to somewhat just summarize, what we spoke about last week is this final part here, is this first part here on the source sheet, source number one, and where Rav Soloveitchik in many ways kind of summarizes everything we've said until now. And he says, the halakha was well aware that biologically and physiologically, there is little difference between man and animal. Medical research is based upon the similarity of both concerning all organic pathological phenomena. We talked about this last week. He puts tremendous store in this fact that ultimately, when push comes to shove, we aren't that different from animals. The whole premise of animal research and science is that if it works for rats and it works for other sorts of animals, then there is a high likelihood it will work for us too, because we share enough similarities that that's going to be the case. That's kind of, you know, the bedrock of it. In the same way, the concept of tereifa. Tereifa is a halachic thing where either an animal or a human being possesses some sort of issue with a treif is commonly used to describe something non-kosher, but technically a tereifa is something that you're not gonna see out the year. Someone has something wrong with them that they are gonna die before, you know, a 12-month kind of period is over. That is, you know, so an animal that is tereifa is not kosher, and somehow that became, you know, the word we use to describe all non-kosher, but the concept of tereifa, which denotes any organic anomaly, structural and functional, refers to animal and man alike. So again, we saw that last week. Rav Soloveitchik points out that halachically speaking, halacha also views humans and animals in very, very similar ways. So that's ontically. We are not much different than the animals. So now comes the ethics, and to just kind of put aside the sources for now, this actually comes, if you were reading the book, this actually comes, they made the chapters as they wanted and divided it into sections as they wanted, but this is still within the first section, but I left it until today. As I mentioned, there's three sections, so, and we have 3 weeks, but I'm actually kind of, you know, juggling it slightly because this introduction to ethics, which he does kind of first, before the second section, nonetheless, we're doing now, but it still builds off the biological similarities between us and all other creatures. And basically, all creatures, including ourselves, have drives. And those drives, as Rav Soloveitchik point out, lead us to act. So think of hunger. Biologically speaking, we have a biological response. Our body realizes it needs to eat, it needs those calories, so it triggers us, and that drive to eat leads us to eat. It's very simple. Squirrels do it, rats do it, that bug that was crawling around our, you know, kitchen until I took it in, until I got rid of it 15 minutes ago, works exactly the same way we do. We get hungry, we deal with it. The problem is that at a certain point, the satisfaction we gain from that satiation of the drive leads us to become pleasure-seeking. And this is something that kind of is talked about kind of in take the science of weight gain. That is, there's an excellent book called The Hungry Brain, which really gets into the neuroscientific and evolutionary psychological aspect to kind of weight gain, which is all about our bodies were never built to have the abundance of food we have, and so we just kind of are constantly eating even though we don't need to. But the point is that pleasure seeking leads to overabundance. So in the case of weight gain, we don't need to always, you know, scratch that hunger itch the way we do, but we do, therefore we become overweight, and generally this is what happens. With all biological stimuli, we can end up chasing the pleasure. And what happens is that these drives, which are supposed to be used in the service of the species, says Rav Soloveitchik, eventually lead us to focusing on the individual instead. Rav Soloveitchik does point out that's not always a bad thing. An individual focusing on themselves can lead to creativity. Rav Soloveitchik loves creativity. He thinks creativity is one of the most important things, you know, ever. But what it can also lead to is indulgence. So basically, we have these drives, these biological drives, just like all the other animals, and they lead us to act. But there is a problematic aspect to it, which is we can overindulge at times and become consumed, not just by trying to satisfy our biological need, but instead pursue pleasure. And this is where Rav Soloveitchik starts to locate his point in creation itself. So if you take a look now on the source sheet, sources 2 and 3, there's a few different things going on here. But for now, if you take a look at source number 2, so it's the creation of fish. Vayvarech otam Elohim le'mor peru o'revu u'mil'u et hamayim bayamim v'ha'of yirev ba'aretz. So be fertile and increase, peru or revu, that is the instillment of the biological sex drive, the biological drive to procreate. And if you take a look also in source 3, beginning verse 28, basically the exact same thing. We're going to return shortly to the thing that's different, but vayvarech otam Elohim, vayom Elohim Elohim, peru or revu umelu et haaretz v'chivshuha. So again, this exact same acknowledgement of the exact same drive, just as the animals and the fish, every biological organism is peru or revu, is commanded to procreate, so too are humans. There is one important difference already is v'chiv shuha, this idea of conquest, of control, already starting to indicate there is supposed to be something different about humans. Not necessarily ontically, not necessarily as physical creatures, it's the same, but there is supposed to be another purpose. And to get a better sense, if you take a look already at source number 4, so you'll see source number 4 has a few different paragraphs to it. We're just going to focus on the first paragraph right now before the ellipses, and where Rav Soloveitchik kind of, you know, summarizes this idea. Man is good under all three aspects. Number one, as a biochemical organism, a plant, endowed with all the organic insistences and propensities. Number two, as an animal with all his automatic, primordial, biological act dynamics, the sexual drive, the appetite. So these are the two things that basically the peru revu, the this, the that, we have the exact same, you know, we are just upgraded animals, And as a man animal, so still, we are still supposed to, you know, not change in the fact that we're upgraded animals, but who brought his biological motivation to perfection and converted it to a technical intelligence which guides man in his execution of the biological drive. This is the v'chiv shuha, the conquest is we aren't just like all other animals, which just kind of, they get the drive, they just, you know, go, you know, all consuming attempt to fulfill that drive and there you go. We have a certain awareness of that drive, a certain knowledge of the drive, and so we can facilitate it in other ways. We can maybe push it off slightly in order to facilitate it in a better sense. We have that technical awareness, that technical intelligence of how to, you know, really use it, but we are still driven by those same things. We can just wield them differently, or we can just, you know, we can, they can work for us in slightly different ways. And then he says something fascinating. It is at this point that Judaism breaks with Christianity. Christianity has been bent upon a transcendental adventure, namely, to free man from his bondage to the flesh and raise him to a spiritual level. Judaism, in contrast, proclaimed the goodness of the whole man, of the natural man, plant, animal. So something we are going to see is that for Rav Soloveitchik, our animalistic aspect is not a bad thing. When used in service of the ethical, it is in fact how things are supposed to be. But so fundamentally, the fact that we are upgraded animals is not a bad thing. We are supposed to achieve the ethical through our regular kind of animal aspects within us. But it's the working of those, as we're gonna see, that really is the game changer.
Is he reading the Kishuva as conquer those drives?
More the idea that it signifies a distinction just between us and everything else. So the conquest is not so much the conquest of ourselves as much as you are being highlighted to do something different in the world. So you have, we are still animals, but we have already at this point been designated as slightly different from the rest of the animals. That seems to be how he's reading it. The major significance Rav Soloveitchik attaches to the difference between sources 2 and 3, I put it in the board in the Hebrew, I forgot to put it in the board in the English, but you'll see. So again, verse 2. At source 2, Vayvarech otam Elokim lemor, God blessed them and said, Peru Ravu, he commanded them in Peru Ravu. In contrast, in source 3, verse 28, Vayvarech otam Elokim, that's the same as before, he blesses them, Vayomer lohem Elokim. He turns to them and speaks, and then commands them in Vayomer, and then commands them in Peru Ravu, which leads us to, if you take a look at the second paragraph in source number 4, Rav Soloveitchik explains that significance. The simple word Vayomer, he said, sheds a new light upon man and upon his role and task. The Vayavarech does not constitute any norm or ethical law. But in the case of man, God also spoke to him. He informed him of his biological propensities and tendencies. Through his speech to man, God registered in the latter's mind the necessity of this automatic drive, the transforming of it into a conscious, deliberate, anticipated act directed upon the same objective. The automatic push and blind forced movement of Vayavarech turn into a conscious drive and intelligent movement of Vayomer. In contrast to animals, man yields to his natural instinct, not only because he is driven by biochemical forces to such behavior, but also because he is motivated through Vayomer, biological mechanical drives and teleological intelligent motifs are interwoven. The difference between man and all the other animals is that the Vayavarech, which is seen here as the instilling of the biological drive of Peru Uravu, of procreation, For man, it's accompanied by Vayomer Lahem Elokim. God also tells them. He informs man of the fact that he's been implanted with this drive. And that awareness is key, because if you know you have it, you can anticipate and you can work with it and you can bend it to other purposes. You can use it to achieve greater aims. All the other animals, again, our hunger is not fundamentally distinct from any other animal's hunger, but as Rav Soloveitchik claims, we are aware of what our hunger means and what it teaches us and what we can do with it. We can't run away from it. You can never, ever run away from a drive. If you try to not eat, you'll die. Like we cannot, you know, truly, you know, you, if something's a drive, you can't run away from it. It's interwoven into your very biological being, but the knowledge of it itself is empowering. And I just want to read this final paragraph here where Rav Soloveitchik really, really kicks it, and then we'll take a couple of questions. At this point, man is made aware of it and it's implanted in him, but this awareness, nothing is activated with this awareness. Adam in Bereshit Perek Aleph in the first chapter of Genesis has nothing to do, says Rav Soloveitchik, with this knowledge. He just has it. But if you take a look at the final paragraph of source 4, however, Adam is still an animal crawling in the jungle, still the ape which is aware of its needs. Man may have acquired a technical intelligence that makes tools and organizes, that's v'chivshuha, but his awareness was utilitarian, was technical. He possessed the ability of selecting the media that guaranteed a successful performance by instinct. The specific human element, the moral agent, had not yet come to birth. Unique ethical norms were as yet impossible. So at this point, ethical man has not emerged. For Rav Soloveitchik, ethical man has been primed. Man has been created ontically, no different than the animals, possessing the exact same drives, the exact same needs, the exact same biological urges as all of the creatures. The crucial difference is God has informed humans that they possess these drives. And that already does allow them to do certain things. Again, the analogy he doesn't bring, but the example might be, you know, animals seek food, so they'll grab whatever they can. Humans will plant and wait for that time for those plants to grow and then use the, you know, whatever's been grown to transform that into further food. That sort of idea, that's the technical intelligence, that we are aware of those drives. We are aware that if we quash them slightly, we will be able to yield greater things later on. That's the technical intelligence, but that is still upgraded animal. That is the animal that will control the world, that will dominate and conquer the world, because it has that technical intelligence to be just a more superior animal. This is where science and Judaism for Rav Soloveitchik still have not parted ways, because ultimately man is still the upgraded animal in Bereshit Aleph. What has yet to emerge is ethical man. And that is what we're going to turn to now. But first, we have a couple of questions. You still have questions? Okay, great. So before we turn to the verses, it's at this point that Rav Soloveitchik tells us what an ethical norm is. And there are three components, says Rav Soloveitchik, to an ethical norm. The first is, it must be a choice. He has this great phrase, the possibility of sin is the mother of the ethical act. It has to be something you can choose. It can't be, again, starve yourself. That can't be an ethical command, because you can't. You can't physically, if you don't eat, that's going to be a huge problem. You must eat. So an ethical norm has to be the restraining of either something that's not an innate drive or the restraining of part of it. But you must have a choice. It can't be something that's impossible to not fulfill. And it obviously can't be something that just wouldn't, you know, like don't, an ethical norm can't be, don't fly because we can't fly. You know, that kind of idea. It has to be something we can do, but it has to be something we have a choice. The second thing is that it has to come with an awareness of our uniqueness. Only when man realizes that he, and by man I mean humanity realizes that we are separate from everything else, we are unique and distinct, only then can the ethical norm be introduced. And third, and here is where Rav Soloveitchik really leans into existentialist language, it must involve an I-thou awareness, which we're going to talk about a bit more shortly. But it must make us realize that we are one with, yet separate from, a community of values. It must involve, an ethical norm must involve a relationship between two people where they don't see each other purely as objects, but they see each other as part of each other's community while also being distinct. All these three things are going to come into play very shortly. These things, up until now, have not been present. None of these things happen in Sefer Bereshit until Source 5. I realized, and I was conscious I was doing this as I made the source sheet, but only today did I realize it was dumb, that I actually just dropped a couple of verses that are familiar enough that we don't really need to read them, but Source 5 nonetheless has some crucial verses, and the other crucial verses, you know, are familiar ones. But first, let's take a look at source number 5. Vayetzav Adonai Elohim al ha'adam le'mor, and God commands Abraham saying, commands Adam saying, Mikol eitz hagan achol tochel, of every tree of the garden you are free to eat, umi eitz hada'at tov vara lo tochel mimenu, except for this one tree, ki v'yom achalcha mimenu mot tamut, for the moment you do so, you'll die. The fact that doesn't happen, let's just ignore. The point is that man is commanded, vayetzav. And this is the crucial third utterance of God to man, as it were, that transforms man from merely an animal into the possibility of becoming an ethical being. We have the vayavarech. The vayavarech is the implanting of the drive. The vayomer is God informing man of this drive, but the vayetzav is the creation of a taboo. This is not rooted in biology. Don't eat of that tree. There is no reason whatsoever to not eat from that tree except God says so. It's almost an intentionally arbitrary thing. But that is the ethical imperative for Rav Soloveitchik. The whole point is, it's something, and again, we use ethics nowadays to mean a whole host of other things, but for Rav Soloveitchik, the whole point is, it's specifically the you do something just cause. You restrain yourself. Adam and Chava have a drive to eat, but they are told that is the one thing. They can eat everything else, but there is one thing, the creation of the ethical imperative, just don't do this just because. But you can't do it. And this is the creation of the ethical imperative, and this, sorry, just Adam. Adam and Chava is not there yet, which we're about to talk about. But correct. So we'll yes. But so again, so one thing I'll say this at this point because of that question. Rav Soloveitchik reads these entire three chapters of Sefer Bereshit allegorically, and something that's often important. So first of all, that does not mean, and again, what Rav Soloveitchik thought about the literal, you know, historical value of these stories is not something we know and is not the concern, but when you read something allegorically, you care less about the specific plot points and more about the general trends. So for instance, you know, if you take any piece of literature whatsoever, and you're reading it for allegorical value, it doesn't necessarily matter that in chapter 3, a certain character does something that kind of, you know, doesn't seem to fit with the broader allegory, because you accept that there are certain plot points that might not work, but the allegory as a whole, and Rav Soloveitchik clearly, as we get into chapter 3 of Sefer Bereshit, Rav Soloveitchik, it doesn't make a perfect one-to-one correspondence with the verses, but that's not going to stop him from coming up with an absolutely brilliant allegory. So yes, Adam here is already in existence. In Bereshit Perek Bet, woman does not exist yet, and that's actually crucial, and that was the verse I forgot to put on here, but is so, so crucial because at the moment Adam is given the ethical imperative, the very next verse is God needs to find a partner for man. Why? Because man is no longer together with all the other animals. And an ethical imperative involves, stage 1, it must be a choice. there is now a choice to eat from this tree or not eat from this tree. The creation of a taboo. It's not trying to violate a drive. It's trying to control a certain aspect of that drive. Step two, Adam now becomes aware of his uniqueness. He is now different. He is the only animal in the garden possessing an ethical imperative. Thus, he is now unique. And God suddenly realizes he needs a vow. He needs an other who will be his equal, who will be his partner, who will share that same role as him. None of the other animals can do this, and therefore God realizes Adam is lonely and needs someone else. Now that he's unique, he needs that partner. The creation of woman gives Adam a community. He's now part of a broader community of two, admittedly not the world's greatest community, but I guess when there's only two human beings on the planet, it's a very, very large community. But the point is, we now have the creation of community. And this leads Rav Soloveitchik to use, as he himself says, discuss original sin. He says he wants to talk about original sin. However, he's very clear that he's going to divert from the way Christians understand this story. He still thinks there is ultimately a sin and that this has massive repercussions for humanity as a whole. But as we'll see, and he himself says, when you look at it through a Jewish lens, as he argues, it yields very different conclusions, are his words. And this is where we turn to the third chapter of Sefer Bereshit. So for Rav Soloveitchik, this story is not just about the emergence of ethical man, but also the transformation of humanity from the ethical into the pleasure-seeking, into the hedonic beings that they weren't supposed to be. But this is the story of what happened. This is the allegory that teaches how humanity falls from its potential of being ethical instead into the pleasure-seeking, into the hedonic. It's an allegory, and Rav Soloveitchik at this point starts talking most specifically about sexual life, about sexual relationships and how that encapsulates so much of the role of ethical man and the dangers of slipping into hedonic pursuits. So the first thing he notes, before we turn again to any sources, is that, and Fred, you already mentioned, in the first chapter, so now we pick up with the fact that man and woman in the first chapter are zachar unakeva, male and female. In the second chapter, and now on, they are now called ish v'ishto, husband and wife. So there is this idea that they are no longer mere, you know, lion, lioness. It's no longer just biological things, man and woman, but rather they are the community, they are a marriage, they are a partnership, they are ish v'ishto, husband and wife. And this means, says Rav Soloveitchik, that the command of Peru or Revu of procreation is no longer a biological drive. It's solely a biological drive. That component still exists, but now it brings the potential for much more than that, what he terms ethical solidarity. What was once for Rav Soloveitchik, just one second, quote, dull, meaningless biology, becomes an ethical performance, one that drives people to establishing community. For Rav Soloveitchik, the ethical purpose of the sexual drive is to leave people, and this is kind of a great quote, it leads people to overcome their aloofness and aloneness to join the alien thou. The whole point is that it drives people out from their community as one, because in order to fulfill this drive, you need someone else. And the ethical performance of that results in ethical solidarity. It's not simply two animals mating in order to pass on their genes, but there is a broader purpose here. Fred.
Okay, so in terms of the relationship ishto, there are plenty of animals that mate for life. So they're monogamous. They're not just...
That's a great point, but the assumption would be, And I would imagine this would still be a correct assumption, so this is kind of the important point. It's not the point that they are monogamous, but it's the nature of their relationship. So there's two kinds of aspects that are together, that potentially can be together, but there's the aesthetic. There's the hedonic pleasure that comes from the mating, but there's also the ethical. There's the union of two people, the I-thou relationship, the seeing each other as partners, as others, as equals. The first, the pleasure, all animals will have. And again, the fact that animals become monogamous doesn't change the fact that the assumption is they don't have, I would imagine, swans. Definitely in the mind of Rav Soloveitchik, swans don't have deep relationships with one another. They may be monogamous, but they don't have that I-thou relationship. They are still two animals driven. It's not two people having that act of ethical solidarity. It's not the monogamy, it's the nature of the two humans coming together for Rav Soloveitchik. What Rav Soloveitchik does stress is that the example he is talking about is a sexual relationship, but it's not the only one. It's the means, not the cause. One can have, and again, this goes back to, one can have ethical solidarity with a lot of different people. Obviously, the means will be very different. The point is, there are many different ways one can see their fellow human being with the I-thou relationship, with seeing each other as true others without, you know, the sexual relationship, obviously, the husband and wife, which is the center of this story, and the easiest one to understand for Rav Soloveitchik, but it's just one example. Ultimately, people can obviously create community and have ethical solidarity with a whole variety of different people. What happens, however, is the story of the forbidden fruit. And take a look at source number 6. And Rav Soloveitchik points out the amount of, you know, he reads so brilliantly the language here. So the first thing is, V'hanachash haya arum. The serpent was the shrewdest, mikol chayot hasadeh, of all the beasts of the field, asher asa Adonai Elohim, that God had created. Vayomer el ha'isha, afki amar Elohim, lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan. And thus the serpent begins his temptation of Chava. Rav Soloveitchik notes something really, really clever here. And you'll already see in verse 6, God is described, when God is being described as the creator, he's Hashem Elohim. In contrast, when the snake himself speaks, Vayomer el ha'isha af ki amar Elohim lo tochlu, did God, not the Lord God, but just God. Rav Soloveitchik attaches tremendous significance to this because the truth is, now I forget the count. I want to say it's 19. There are 19 times in chapters 2 and 3 the phrase Hashem Elohim occurs. It occurs only once more in the whole of the Torah. These two chapters are defined by this double reference to God, but the snake denies it. He only refers to God by one of his terms. And for Rav Soloveitchik, this is significant because remember, the snake is not a commanded being. God did not speak to him. Unlike the humans where God both blessed and spoke to them, God both gave them a drive and informed them of the drive. For Rav Soloveitchik, the snake was only ever given the drive. He cannot understand God. For the snake, God has no capacity for ethical. He's merely a tyrant. He's telling these other people they can't do something, but there's absolutely zero justification for it because the snake, for Rav Soloveitchik, the snake is like the ultimate expression of evil. And again, he leans into these really Christian terms of like, it's almost the representative of the devil, of everything evil in the world. Rav Soloveitchik takes that and runs with it. For the snake is not a commanded being. The snake was not introduced to any ethical norm, and so it sees God's forbidding of the tree. It can't understand that purpose because it's not an ethical being. It can't look at the law God has proposed and understand it as anything other than capriciousness. God is just not allowing you to do something, and you know, he's shocked. Af ki amar Elokim lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan. Did God really say this? So again, you know, it's partly to tempt her, but it also kind of carries with it some of his own shock. Like, would God really do this? He is not Hashem Elohim. He's merely Elohim. He's merely just a God, a powerful being. But, you know, that's it. And then for Rav Soloveitchik, the crucial thing here happens at the moment of the eating. And it's words that, you'll see, I intentionally did not translate some of the words into the English. Source 7. Vatera ha'isha ki tov ha'etz lema'achal. That it was tov. Good, but we're going to talk about that in a second. To eat, v'chi ta'avahu le'enayim. It was a ta'ava, a lust to her eyes. V'nechmad ha'etz lahaskil. It's beautiful to look at. V'atikach mirpiyo v'tochal. And she ate from it. V'atitein gam le'isha ima v'yochal. And she also gives it to her husband to eat. So Rav Soloveitchik offers, I think, absolutely brilliant creative reading. We usually think of the Eitz Hadat Tov Vara, the tree of knowledge of good or evil, as this is a moral thing. But Rav Soloveitchik points out, Tov doesn't always mean moral good. It can also mean aesthetic good. It can mean, it's an ambiguous term. It can either refer to something morally good or just something that's nice to look at. The famous, the most curious example he uses is Yosef's dreams. We'll be reading about them in a few weeks. They are seven good cows. We're not talking about their moral virtue here. We're talking about whether they are fat cows. They are healthy cows. They are good cows. They are aesthetically pleasing cows. Says Rav Soloveitchik, the whole point here is that this is not necessarily just a tree. This is not necessarily a story just about the gaining of moral knowledge. It's about the gaining of beauty, of aesthetic pleasure. Not for naught does, you know, Eitz Hadat, which we usually translate of tree of knowledge, that is also a euphemism in the Torah for a sexual relationship. The whole word, all of the imagery in Source 7 is that deep kind of animalistic idea. The fruit is beautiful to look at, and she lusts for it. Ta'ava means a lust, which again is not the, is the kind of the animalistic drive, the hedonic drive. And what happens at this point is that they succumb. And at this point, they grasp the idea of hedonic pleasure. Ethical man, placed, or man-animal, placed in Gan Eden, turned into an ethical being through the command, nonetheless succumbs very quickly and is unable to control those drives in the service of the ethical, and instead allows those drives to control him in the service of pleasure. For Rav Soloveitchik, this is a story about human beings unable to control their drives and instead giving into them and succumbing to them and instead pursuing a life of pleasure. And this, for Rav Soloveitchik, take a look at source number 8. So he points out, the excuses given by Adam and Chava are absolutely ludicrous. God's like, what are you doing? Paraphrase. Vayomer ha'adam, ha'isha asher natata imadi hi natna li min ha'etz va'ochal. The woman you gave to me, she gave it to me and I ate. Which is both a terrible excuse, but as Rav Soloveitchik points out, that's also exactly what happened. She gave him fruit, he was unable to resist, and so he did it. Vayomer Adonai Elohim li'isha ma'azot asit. Woman, what did you do? Vatomer ha'isha nach asher va'ochal. The serpent duped me, tempted me, and I ate. That is literally the explanation of the pursuit of pleasure. I just did it. I wasn't really in control at the time. It just happened. Like, we read this excuse as really, really dumb and stupid. But for Rav Soloveitchik, no. That is literally what happens when ethical man falls to pursuing hedonic pleasure. It just... She showed me the fruit and I ate it. The serpent convinced me and boom. There is no moral calculus. And this is, if you look at source number 9, again, just also wonderful kind of, you know, sentences. But it is typical of the original sin that the moment of seduction was introduced into the story of the tree of knowledge. Man did not sin because he chose to violate the divine injunction. Adam was seduced by Eve, and she in turn was seduced by the serpent. The human tragedy did not originate by free choice, but by a hypnotic force. The aesthetic experience with all its compelling power. The first sin was perpetrated in a mood of aesthetic revolt, which was not fomented by a free man, but suggested to him by the serpent. They didn't choose to do this. They just lost control. And this is, and for Rav Soloveitchik, the major departure, I'm not an expert on Christianity, but I'm pretty certain for Christianity, the whole point of original sin is kind of sex is not really a good thing. This giving into drives is not a good thing. Rav Soloveitchik, no. It is a good thing when it leads to ethical union. The problem is we're not controlled. That is really the problem of this story. But what this teaches us is that man didn't rebel. Just succumbed to those drives. The whole ethical man emerges out of his biological self. We are, and this is something that Rav Soloveitchik writes about in a lot of other places too, this idea of the mastery of ourselves. That's the point, that we have these biological drives, and they themselves aren't bad, but it is the control, it's the observance of the command, which leads to us being ethical. And for Rav Soloveitchik, the almost the tragedy of this story is that by succumbing to hedonic pleasure, it breaks the ethical solidarity between husband and wife. Because no longer is it an I-thou relationship, two people coming together in a union, but instead it goes back to being an I-it relationship. They see each other simply as tools in order to fulfill their, you know, pleasure-seeking drive. That's all it is. And that's why for Rav Soloveitchik, the element of shame comes in. The whole thing is, earlier in the story, they are naked, they aren't bothered, suddenly they are embarrassed by the fact that they are naked, and says Rav Soloveitchik, and independent of everything else, I think this is a really fascinating point he makes, he goes, there's two kinds of shame you will feel. The first kind of shame is all of us in our minds have kind of our ideal version of ourselves. And there's a kind of shame you will feel if someone gains an insight into the person you want to be and sees you aren't. You feel shame. You feel shame that you aren't the person you want to be if someone else finds it out. But there's an even greater aspect of shame. And that is, we all portray ourselves to be a certain person, to be a certain kind of person. We want people to see us a certain way. The worst kind of shame happens when we are exposed for who we really are. When people see that the person we have been projecting forward is merely a facade, and really we are something else. That is true shame. The shame for Rav Soloveitchik in this story, experienced by Adam and Chava, is that they realize that they were simply treating each other as it. Again, this is allegorical, so at which point is it talking about sexual relationships, at which point is it just talking about eating from fruit? But that's the point of allegorical stories. But the point is, they realize that the ethical union was not the main motivating force, but purely the pleasure-seeking aspect was what was motivated them. And trying to portray to each other the fact that that ethical, you know, experience, but that wasn't actually what was happening. And thus, the moment they eat from the tree, and they realize they are hedonic beings, that they pursue pleasure, that's the moment they realize, oh, we aren't the great people we are portraying ourselves to be. That's the moment they feel shame. And for Rav Soloveitchik, the key stories in Sefer Bereshit, the first kind of 11 chapters, are all about people viewing other people simply as its. And when you see someone else merely as an it, you seek dominion, you seek control, you seek power over them. The strongest example of this is the generation just before the flood, which is perpetrated by, the Torah uses the term Hamas, violence. A society of violence is one that simply objectifies each other. They see each other as merely, you know, barriers in the way of getting to what they want, and thus they'll murder each other, they'll do whatever they want to each other in order to pursue their hedonic pleasure. The failure of humanity in these first 11 chapters of Sefer Bereshit is the failure of pursuing hedonic pleasure, of ignoring the ethical norm. That's why God has to destroy the world. That's why he realizes something has gone horribly wrong, and I need to press restart, because the first human beings set this course on for the rest of humanity of being and pursuing pleasure above all else, and that is the problem. And to just turn now to source number 10 to kind of end off here, is the final, what is the final two paragraphs of this section of The Emergence of Ethical Man, and sets up the next section. And he says the following: man became selfish, treacherous, and unnatural. God condemned man. Creation of man seemed to be an absolute failure, kviyachol, as it were. And the Lord repented that he had made man. At the beginning of the story of Noah, God regrets having ever created us. God regretted the creation of man, the orgiastic, aesthetic type dominated mankind. Hamas was the guiding motif of human activities, and the demonic superseded the divine personality. The catastrophe by which God punished man, the deluge, did not solve the problem completely. It improved man, yet it did not heal the breach in his personality. And this is Rav Soloveitchik's way of saying, I'm just going to skip a ton of chapters of Sefer Bereishit and skip a bit. Through devious ways and zigzag channels, Providence began to realize a new human personality, the charismatic. Abraham was born, chosen, and charged with a mission by God. Abraham was selected to rehabilitate man and to reinstate him to the ideal position with which he was destined to occupy. Kviyachol, God needed characteristic man to appear on the human stage. And thus, next week we will talk about this. And even though the book is called The Emergence of Ethical Man turns out to be a failure. Ethical man turns out not to work. God created, ontic man. Ontic man is just an animal. But what he also did while instilling in him all the drives all the other animals had, is he also made man aware of these drives, gave him the technical knowledge to sometimes control them for the pursuit of his conquest of the world, and then commands man. Turns man into his own ethical community, husband and wife, but the very first thing they do is fall. The very first thing they do is unable to uphold that ethical charge. Instead, they slip and they go to the complete other extreme, and thus they become consumed by the desire for pleasure. That biological drive, which the biggest problem can be, indulgence. That is the flip side to the problem with humanity, is that we can too easily indulge in this side of our drives. That's what happens. That leads a whole situation of a world of Hamas, which leads God to regret creation. And thus a new type of person must set foot onto the world stage, charismatic man. And what we will talk about next week is how Rav Soloveitchik sees the story of Abraham and the story of Moshe as teaching us what charismatic man is and the true solution to this quandary.